Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. We have a huge batch of mailbags questions, as always, for our second podcast of the week. But first, we're going to dig into the All-Star voting results. The starters were announced today, and I have a crime to report. I am really, really beside myself over here. And first of all, did you see who got selected or no?
I did. I saw enough to be happy for you that DeMar DeRozan was named an All-Star starter. Beyond that, I saw that Russell Westbrook wasn't. I've been out all night. It's Thursday night and all this stuff just came out. So catch me up. Tell me your biggest beefs with the process.
Well, look, first of all, let's talk about the results, not the process. The process is so complicated. Everybody who watched it saw Shaq's eyes glaze over, Charles Barkley's eyes glaze over as Ernie tried to explain it with his fuzzy math. So we don't want to dig too deeply into that. But the results, everyone's going to flock to Curry over Westbrook. I understand that. I mean, it is pretty shocking to be in a world where Westbrook doesn't get to start, but it's at least justifiable, right? Like, we can come up with a case for Curry.
Yeah, so that seems to be like the flashpoint for backlash early on, at least. And I just want to say that I could not care less that Russell Westbrook is not starting the All-Star game. It does not matter to me. And it, like, I would understand being more upset about it, but like, Steph has had almost as good a year, first of all, is as good or better as a player generally. And like, Steph down the stretch in that OKC Golden State series last year whooped Russ's ass. So like, people need to chill out with the outrage here.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, it's at least defensible. I picked Westbrook, as we talked about previously. I was surprised that he wasn't able to kind of sneak it out, but the system was all screwed up. There was a tie. It had to go to a tie break, and Curry won because he had more fan votes. And ultimately, like, that's tough. I mean, it's hard to compete with a guy who's won two MVPs back-to-back, who's been kind of the golden boy for the last few years. That's what held Westbrook back. I mean, if you look at the fan vote and the player vote, he fared better than Steph. So we can put that one on the fans, and it wasn't, I mean, the fans have screwed up before. This wasn't like new ground, but this was not the crime that I need to report.
You know? Wait. First of all, before we get into whatever Toronto related beef you have, what I kind of enjoy about this process is that it's all opaque enough so that like, there's a chance the NBA could be rigging things, or if the NBA wanted to, could screw with the results however it wanted to.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the way that the formula came out was so convoluted that it did kind of seem like they had maybe one eye towards ensuring certain guys made it or not. But here's what I would say. The actual process sort of worked, because what it did do was take out all of the junk garbage candidates from the fan vote. So like, Zaza Pachulia like was not even close to getting it. And you look at some, like, even like a Joel Embiid, where he's really making his case on Twitter and trying to be goofy and running up the score there. He was very close to getting in. And if it had been just a fan vote, he would have started. Instead, a guy who I think that we would agree is more deserving, Jimmy Butler, gets to start because of the way that they sort of fixed this process. So,
yeah, I mean, look, Embiid as a starter would have been fun, though. And Zaza would have been hilarious enough and ridiculous enough to eliminate the fan vote forever. So I would have been fine with that too. It was Dwayne Wade starting that would have really upset me and like turned me against the fans forever.
And this process fixed that. So, I mean, if you want to give the NBA general credit for their electoral college system, I mean, it sort of worked on balance in terms of getting the least deserving guys out of there.
Yeah, I just think it's funny that nobody understands how this works. And I think that creates a situation where the NBA could, if it wanted to, take advantage of everyone's confusion. I'm not saying that happened.
Yeah, hold on one second, though. I do think had Westbrook gotten in, everyone would have been just completely fine with the way that the NBA structured this.
Yeah.
And the fact that he didn't, and he's been such a centerpiece of all the conversation about the amazing stats this year, the triple-double average and all of that, to have him not make it, even though it's sort of justifiable based on Curry's popularity and the Warriors' success. Does undermine the entire rest of the process and kind of, you know, digs into the credibility a little bit, I think. And that's unfortunate because I think on balance, the NBA did okay here.
Yeah. And also, who cares?
Yeah. And he's going to make anyway, so whatever. Yeah. But the crime here, I mean, I really, DeMar DeRozan starting over Kyle Lowry not starting and Isaiah Thomas not starting, John Wall not starting. I mean, look, I think on a previous podcast, I said I would have had him sixth among the East guards. I went through very carefully. I'm going to give him fifth on the East guards. I'm going to bump him slightly above Kemba. But there's just no case to be made that he should be starting and Kyle Lowry isn't. And I think we got to give Kyle Lowry a lot of credit here because he immediately went on Twitter and kind of had a joke about it, congratulating DeRozan. I don't know if I would have been that big of a person if I was Kyle Lowry. I think I might have been a little ticked off because you look at the impact numbers, it's just not even close. I mean, the Raptors are actually worse on offense and defense when DeRozan's on the court compared to when he's off. You look at Lowry, it's the exact opposite. They're better, far better on offense and better on defense when he's on the court. I mean, you take Lowry off that team, they struggle to be a 500 team.
Yeah.
You take DeRozan off that team, they might lose, you know, 3 to 4 or 5 more games than they are, you know, currently. I mean, it's not
even such
a debate.
You're such a hater. I am so happy that I had a vote, did not put DeMar in the starting lineup. I'm not surprised at all that he was chosen by, what was his breakdown? I bet the players picked him.
Yeah, so that's where it got interesting because everyone screwed this up. I mean, every single person. We had DeMar finished third among the East guards in the fan vote, third among the East guards in the player vote, and second among East guards in the media vote. So I'm really disappointed in our media colleagues for falling for the points per game number and for completely underrating Lowry. Lowry was only fourth in the media vote, but Lowry was fifth among the players vote. And I thought these players were supposed to really know the game inside and out and really know who the true stars were. I mean, give me an absolute break. And if I was a player, I'd vote for DeMar too, because he wouldn't guard me in the All-Star game. I can go score easily. It's perfect.
Great. I'm just really happy. So that's a solid comeback there. But I'm just happy that they did this to you after you questioned whether DeMar DeRozan was an All-Star at all. Again, okay. I'm not a DeRozan stan, but when a guy plays this well through the first 2.5 months of the year, he deserves some love throughout the league, and I'm glad that he's getting it. And my other question to you would again be like you talk about whether Kyle Lowry, whether you'd be like that big of a person. Do you actually think Kyle Lowry cares about something like this? Kyle Lowry's been an All-Star starter in the past.
He should. Because he's devoted his entire life to the craft. I mean, he should take it seriously. These guys love flipping out when they get, you know, quote unquote snubbed on our player rankings. They should get a little bit upset about this as well. And that leads me into my next point, which is the players in their voting. First of all, everyone's going to talk about how bad some of the votes were. And there were some completely unjustifiable votes. I mean, guys who haven't even played minutes this year got votes. But the real story, I think, from the player votes is that they're a bunch of player haters. I'm going to list some of the guys who the players underrated compared to both the fan vote and the media vote.
And first of all, that's what I was most excited about with the player voting in general is like how many guys just didn't have Kawhi on the roster at all. How many guys hated on Curry or Durant or whatever it may be. So hit me with it.
No, I'm just going to give you a couple of the names who were the most underrated by the players relative to the fan vote and the media vote. And you tell me if you can sense a pattern here, okay?
Okay.
Draymond Green.
Mm-hmm.
Klay Thompson.
Okay.
Steph Curry.
So are you just going to name the whole Warriors roster?
Andre Iguodala and Zaza Pachulia. Do you sense a pattern here? Do you sense any pattern in this in this list here?
I think I picked up on the pattern.
Player haters. The NBA players are looking at the super team in the Bay Area and they are over it. They're off it. They don't want to hear anything more about it. They'd rather vote for completely less deserving players than...
Are you implying that Iguodala deserved All-Star votes?
No, of course not. All I'm saying is if you line up the actual votes and say, okay, where did the players come out? Where did the media come out? Where did the fans come out? There is a noticeable trend here where guys like Draymond, who to me should have been a starter, not a lot of media guys agreed with me, but they did noticeably worse among the players than these other voting capsules. So you could say, you could flip it and say, okay, the media and the fans are falling in love with the Warriors and overrating them. I mean, you could look at it both ways, but to me, it's hard to overrate a team that's on a 70 win pace, leading the league, unbelievable offense, unbelievable defense, and super top heavy, you know, lots of star talent. I mean, that's a little interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. I think it confirms, like, that's how players should feel about what the Warriors have done and are doing. And like, I don't really blame other players for kind of thinking it's BS, even though most people wouldn't really go on the record saying that.
There is one other clear player hated player, guy who did significantly worse in the player vote than the other two votes. He is Joel Embiid, Sixers center. Joel Embiid.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the breakdown?
So he finished third among East Front Court in the fan vote, fifth in the media vote. So clearly people were convinced either by, you know, the quality of his play or his hilarity on social media or whatever else, but he only finished eighth among, you know, the Eastern Conference front court bigs. And I mean, there were some pretty shaky names finishing ahead of him as well. So
yeah, I was going to say the East does not have any solid big men. So like that was more than anything, that was the justification to have Embiid in there. It's like, he's clearly the best center in the East. And shout out to Alt Sixers. They've been voting for Embiid as an all-star since like the first week in November. So it's not surprising that he topped out near like a million votes.
So here's some guys who beat him. Paul George among the player vote. Kristaps Porzingis, which actually kind of surprised me. Carmelo Anthony and Kevin Love all did better than Joel Embiid. And then obviously LeBron, Giannis, and Butler did as well. So I think what this tells you is that among his colleagues, Joel Embiid is viewed as corny. I don't think he's got that rep right now.
I'm not going to read that much into it. I think he's viewed as a rookie who also doesn't play like once every four games. So,
all right, that's a fair take. I agree.
That could be it. Can I tell you the one thing that was most disappointing to me is that there were, I think, among media members, there were like eight people who voted Rudy Gobert as a starter. So I would not have been alone. Yeah, I would not have been alone. And instead, I was just a coward who went with the masses and threw Anthony Davis in there by default. And I'm sorry. I think I'm going to try to do my best to do better next year.
So here's some guys who actually were favored by the players more than by the other two voting blocks.
Okay.
And it's an interesting batch of guys. I mean, I'm not sure I see a major trend, but a couple of the guys right off the top, CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard. So clearly like bucket getters, that's not just an all Andrew Sharp team. That's like an all NBA player team.
Dude, just in general, I love how disappointed you are in everyone. Well, everyone associated with this process. You're taking this more seriously than anyone in America. And I love you for it.
Well, look, somebody's got to pick the nits, right? Like, if we're all just going to sit around and pat each other on the back and say, oh, great job, all-star voting. That was so much fun. Let's do it again next year. Hashtag. Like, that's pointless. Okay.
Sure.
Some of the other guys, Bradley Beal did better among the players than he did among the fans. Carmelo Anthony did better among the players than he did among the media, which maybe that's not super surprising. And then Paul George did much better among the players than he did among the media or the fans. So I think in general, you know, marketability and then, you know, scoring ability seems to be what the players kind of favored a little bit more than some of the others, which is interesting. You know, I didn't really know what to expect, but clearly all bets are off if you're a Warriors player. You're going to get dinged if you're a Warriors player. The players did actually show respect to Kevin Durant. So he is the exception here. But other than that, they pretty much bagged on the Warriors.
Well, I think it's pretty funny that like basketball media and smart basketball fans and basically like NBA Twitter spend so much time lashing out at like quote unquote casual fans. And really, when you break it down, like the players themselves are like the ultimate hot take casual fans that people claim to hate so much. So, whether it's marketability or scoring and highlights or whatever, that seems to speak to the players the most. And, you know, again, like I don't really blame them, but it is pretty funny how it all shakes out.
For sure. Okay. Now we're going to play another game. And I've been really okay, looking forward to this.
And then we're moving into mailbag questions.
But you're going to like this, okay? Trust me.
Okay.
I'm gonna list some of the names of guys who received one vote from their fellow players, okay?
Uh-huh.
And remember, players could vote for themselves. So you have to tell me if that player voted for himself or if somebody else voted for him. In other words, is the only person who voted for this person like his teammate, his friend, just some random admirer, or is it the player himself, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to start you off with a real delicious one. Chicago Bulls point guard Rajon Rondo got one vote. Did he vote for himself or did somebody else vote for him?
That's amazing. I would say, yeah, Rondo probably voted for himself.
I think he voted for himself.
A middle finger to the league.
Absolutely. I mean, he had those recent comments about how he couldn't name any three of his teammates from Sacramento. Yeah. Guess what? His teammates couldn't name him either.
Perfect.
All right. We're going to go to another interesting one. Spencer Hawes.
I do not think anyone... I think that was probably someone else. Probably okay. Voted for him as a joke. And it is pretty funny.
Evan Turner. Blazers backup swingman Evan Turner.
You know what? Evan Turner was friends with Spencer Hawes in Philly. Teammates with him for a few
conspiracy.
Years.
Conspiracy. They voted for each other.
No. I would actually say that Evan Turner probably voted for himself and Hawes as a joke.
Okay. How about Raymond Felton?
I have no idea.
How about Alex Len? Sun Center Alex Len.
Yeah, Alex Len probably cast one for himself. Look, you only get so many chances to make history, all right? Like, who knows if Alex Len will even be in the league in a couple years?
Okay, how about Georgios Papagiannis, Kings rookie center? Do you think DeMarcus voted for him?
No, that could be another joke one.
Okay.
From a fellow player.
Omer Asik, do you think Anthony Davis cast his vote for the big enforcer inside who can't even get on the court?
I feel bad. I feel like a lot of these guys are being selected as a punchline. Can I ask you a question? If you were a player, would you vote for yourself?
No. I mean, I take this stuff so seriously. No.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
I mean, unless I could honestly make a case that I deserved it, and let's be real. I mean, there's very unlikely that I'm going to deserve it over Anthony Davis and Kawhi Leonard, whatever position I'm playing. So no, I don't think I would vote for myself. Especially if I had colleagues who were whining about how important and how the players needed to have a voice, I certainly wouldn't waste it by voting for Wesley Johnson, Clippers forward, or Bryn Forbes, Spurs positionless, because we've never heard of him.
I want to say that I would vote for myself because I think it'd be hilarious. And again, you're part of history at that point. But at the same time, I did not even have the guts to vote Rudy Gobert this year. So I clearly, when push comes to shove, I will do the right thing, or at least do the easy thing. I should have chosen the hard right over the easy wrong, but unfortunately.
Did you give any consideration to LaVoy Allen on your ballot? Because no. It looks like he might have voted for himself.
No, but that look, LaVoy was from that Sixers team. So there's a good chance that whoever voted for LaVoy, Spencer Hawes, and Evan Turner was the same person.
Okay. What about Mo Williams? You know, he has basically not played a single minute all season. Did you vote for him?
Are we going to go through every single player who only got one vote?
We literally can't because there's like five dozen. Okay. Players who got at least one vote who not only did they not deserve it, but are just completely ludicrous. And so not only are the players player haters when it comes to their vote, they're also just throwing it away. And it's very
totally.
Disappointing.
And you're disappointed. All right. Do you want to jump into some mailbag questions?
Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to make sure we covered all the bases there. Did you have any beefs with who actually got in? Do we even say who got in? I think we might have skipped over that. It was Anthony Davis, Kawhi Leonard, Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Curry in the West. In the East, it was Butler, Giannis, LeBron. And the backcourt was pretty shaky, DeRozan and Kyrie. So 20 minutes in, now we finally told you who made it.
Yeah. My only two takes on that are, number one, we made it through a 60-minute podcast earlier this week, like 45 of which was dedicated to the All-Star team, and didn't say Kawhi Leonard's name once, which was amazing to me and speaks to how we've all been dealing with the Spurs this year. They've been awesome, and nobody really has paid attention. And then the other thing is, that backcourt is like kind of unacceptable. I know I said I don't care that much about this, but with Wall and Kyle Lowry and Isaiah Thomas, the three of them all deserve to start. And for Kyrie to just slip in there at the last minute. And I guess DeRozan, is DeRozan a guard?
Yeah, DeRozan got that guard spot, the second one all right. behind Kyrie.
So that's bullshit, but hopefully Wall and Isaiah will get a lot of time together. I honestly, like, Kyle Lowry, I think, is leading the league in minutes and does not need to play or care about the All-Star game, but like, he'll definitely be an All-Star. So I think we're good on that front.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's going to be any like real snubs, but it is fun to argue about who should be starters and who shouldn't be. Okay, on to our mailbag questions. I know you front-loaded these with like six more Sixers questions. So everybody dig in if you want to hear some Sixers talk.
So no, we'll do 5 minutes on the Sixers. You also complained that I loaded the bag with Wizards questions. There is one Wizards question, which is apparently one too much. But
my bad.
Philly Mike asks, the people want even more Embiid and Sixers talk on the pod. What happens when Simmons comes back? And Gus, our question MVP, says, how long can you talk about Embiid today? Do you have a favorite stat or anecdote from his year? So you have a stat. You have a couple stats, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have a couple of stats, but there's something a little bit more important than Embiid talk.
What?
Don't we need to get into a blow-by-blow breakdown of TJ McConnell out-dueling DeMar DeRozan down the stretch of an unbelievably tight game, Toronto versus Philly, a possible Eastern Conference Finals preview, and you have TJ McConnell just working the Raptors? Unreal.
That game was actually like awesome. Like, the Sixers are right now, this week, last week, that in the last three games, they've beaten the Hornets, the Bucks, and the Raptors, who are all playoff teams. Like, the Sixers are more fun than any team in the league right now.
Yeah, and they're the only team really that really cares about defense. I mean, that's part of it. Embiid has had an unbelievable impact. You were talking about the stats. I mean, when he's been on, they have the best defense in the league. It's sort of like a Rudy Gobert type phenomenon. When he's off, it's been like the fifth worst defense. So just imagine going from like the Knicks or the Blazers to the Jazz and having one person be the difference there. Of course, he's going to need to scale that in more minutes. I mean, we've talked that to death. He's got to do it every single night. Not playing certain games is going to kind of slant that a little bit, because they're trying to fill all those minutes, and being limited in the games he does play to a certain degree is going to throw that off. But I mean, it's been impressive. And I thought, like, look at Toronto down the stretch. They really struggled to score and get clean looks. I mean, he frustrated Lowry on one drive, had a couple blocks late. I mean, the impact eye test wise and numbers wise is there, and it's fun to see.
Yeah. I have a couple questions here. Number one, don't they, like, watching this all come together like this and watching particularly Nerlens over the past few weeks, don't they have to keep him as sort of like a poor man's Embiid that also is kind of insurance that allows them to play him less minutes than normal? And just like, it seems like they've lucked into a situation where they have like kind of the perfect counterpoint to Embiid.
Well, do you remember when like the Sixers went out there and got like Luke Richard and Bamute for absolutely no reason other than like he was going to be buddies with Embiid?
Yeah.
Embiid is now at the point that was kind of like a transparently obvious move that people kind of mocked, or, you know, at least were like, oh, what are they doing? Like, why do they need that guy? But Embiid is good enough now where he can just have his homies on the roster. Like, that's fine. Like, he's not LeBron. Like, he doesn't get to have four or five of them. But right. if your role for Nerlens Noel is, we're not sure how many minutes we have for you, but you really get along with Embiid and you're keeping our guy happy, then sure, keep him, pay him, whatever it takes. That's fine. Now, once again, another close victory here. They beat the Raptors. The crowd is going crazy, trusting the process. We've got Embiid going nuts, celebrating with McConnell again. Once again, Jahlil Okafor, nowhere to be found. I mean, I'm kind of waiting for the United States' first nuclear crisis here in the next couple of months. And then the Sixers will just leak out that press release. They've just bought him out or something. Like, they're just going to sneak that one out when everybody is distracted with some other topic, because he's a part of the team, but only just, you know.
I think it's time. He's certainly the odd man out at this point. And again, Nerlens suddenly is like a great fit there now that he's not like openly miserable and trashing management. So that's a victory. You go right up and down the roster. Like, everyone is kind of fun and hard to root against. Like, Dario Saric is awesome. Robert Covington is like a pretty effective defensive player. He has a lot of games where he's like 3 of 15 from the field. So if anything, I would say like, tell him just to not shoot and play defense. And that might be a better solution. Although they don't really have anyone else who can shoot, but like all of the pieces are all fun. And just in general, they're like playing with house money this season, which is what makes this like, this is like the most fun you can have rooting for a team, is when there are just zero expectations.
Yeah, what I would say too is that the Embiid situation, with him really having a star type impact here and having that translate into victories, is a reminder of a couple lessons. I mean, number one, winning changes everything. Like, Noel's personality, you know, says the whole story right there. Like, he goes from being the grumpiest guy ever to, you know, practically in tears of joy over a TJ McConnell, Michael Jordan fist pump game winner.
Exactly.
And the second one is just when it comes to role players in the league, like the difference between, you know, the 300th player and the 400th player in the league, or wherever you put some of these role guys that you're mentioning, you know, it's not nearly as important as whether you have a star guy who kind of can be structured around, right? I mean, all those role guys, it's the glass is half empty or the glass is half full, depending on what situation they're in, right? And a lot of those guys that you named are completely forgettable pieces depending on the context. Like, you put them on a certain team's bench, they don't matter. You put them on the Sixers where their one skill is valuable and you just need a little bit of help for Embiid, all of a sudden, you know, it makes sense. And so, to go back to the original question about Ben Simmons, you know, do I expect a star impact here right out of the gate? You know, probably not. But when you're putting in a guy who should be a clearly plus NBA player right off the bat, who knows the things that he can do and is going to be able to do them from day one, you're going to get even more of that benefit with your supporting guys, because those guys are going to have to do less. So I'm super excited to see him. I've been excited since, you know, going back to really his high school days to see what he can do in an NBA situation. And he's coming along at just the right time. The one thing I do worry about, though, is like, does he have the potential to screw this up?
Well, that's the thing.
The momentum is happening here.
I don't think he's going to screw it up, but it is like he's in a pretty weird spot, right? I mean, he's like the number one pick, and meanwhile, the other number one pick, Joel Embiid, is taking over the entire league. So like this, like he was kind of, Simmons was sort of supposed to be the savior, and he's not that guy.
But personality wise, wouldn't you say he's more in that Wiggins camp where it's like better if Embiid is the face?
It might be. Yeah, for sure. I'm just really curious to see how it works, because like I said, all the pieces fit. Everybody, they like the chemistry right now. They're all playing their ass off and like having a lot of fun. And who knows what that will look like when Simmons is in the mix, because like it'll be really interesting to watch that. Like, and that's par for the course with the Sixers, is that like there's always like a new wrinkle.
Yeah, it goes back to Lee's story about Joel Embiid before the season started, where he's like, no, Embiid carries himself like a superstar. It's his team. He thinks it is. And I was skeptical when I read that, because it's like, look, you're going to have to prove that on the court. Like, you don't get to just have that. Otherwise, guys are going to resent you and there's going to be friction, right? And I think he's proven it now. I mean, we've seen it now for long enough where that's who he is. That's who his personality is. I mean, he's egging on the crowd. They're chanting his name, giving him MVP chants. I mean, it's clear it's his team. And I think for Simmons, the question's not going to be, okay, is there going to be some alpha dog fight personality-wise? I'm not necessarily worried about that. What I am worried about is he's going to have a lot of touches. And like any rookie point guard, he's going to struggle with turnovers. He's going to struggle with matchups defensively. And he's going to, you know, need to have the ball a lot. And that's going to be an adjustment for everybody else. Is there a growth period there where some of the Sixers, you know, real serious positive momentum here starts to stall in the short term? And how does he react to the backlash? Because you know people are going to come out and say, oh, everything was going great until Simmons came back.
Totally. I mean,
there's always those idiots out there.
That's why it's interesting.
We'll see what he's made of. I mean, that's going to be the real challenge for him.
One more thing on Embiid is when you were talking earlier and talked about the way he affects some of the role players and just the way he kind of lifts the whole squad. And that's true that like great players do that, but most great young players don't do that. And that I think is what has been most surprising about Embiid is like, he's on another like Giannis is really the only guy in the NBA that can do that consistently and make everyone else on the roster look better. And Embiid is in that category. And I earlier on the pod on Monday, like I talked about the guy from another NBA team who predicted that the Sixers would be the next non-Warriors or Cavs team to win the title. And then in the next breath, he was like, it could all sort of end in a second if Embiid gets hurt. And so that's like another thing to watch. And after that Raptors game, the first thing I thought about was our immunity or our injury immunity question from the mailbag a few weeks ago. Like I don't think I could handle a Joel Embiid injury at this point. So let's retroactively give him immunity.
Yeah, it's the most promising and precarious long-term outlook in the league.
It's wild,
by a mile in both categories. Hey, I have another mailbag question, or are we still going on the Sixers here?
No, we're good. Do your thing.
The question came in from Kid Cootie. I actually believe it was the rapper. he says, what's the best what-if roster in NBA history? And is it Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden being in Oklahoma City together? This year, they're all three MVP candidates, and they were all on the same team once. And they say, keep up the good work. Good job, Andrew. So that's nice of you to say that. So this is not quite what he's going for, but I think it's really pretty mind-blowing.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to make a dream team for the Sacramento Kings. So these are the dream Kings, and we're going to start with Cousins being drafted in 2010, right? And I think the big lesson from Oklahoma City, and then also, I think from Washington's recent success too, it's like if you nail three draft picks in a row, you know, if you're bad and that first pick doesn't quite get you good enough, so you have to draft again. The second one, maybe it's Russell Westbrook learning on the fly, so you have to draft again. And then you nail hard, and all of a sudden, you've got this amazing core, right? You look at the Wizards, Wall, Beal, and Otto Porter. That's starting to look pretty good. And it's kind of back to back to back, right? So imagine what could have been with the Kings. They take Cousins in 2010. They just nail that one, right? 2011, not so much. They take Biombo. They wind up trading it.
That was a terrible draft, though.
It's the Jimmer draft, right?
Yeah.
How about they just take Kawhi Leonard, right? You know, Kawhi came in kind of unpolished.
Come on. Look, if first of all, like people always throw that draft out with Jimmy Butler. I think Jimmy went like 28th. Kawhi went what, 15th?
Yep. But Kawhi remember Kawhi was invited to the green room. I remember because his suit was just completely outrageous and he slipped, right? So he wasn't that far away from where they wound up drafting. Like that's a few spots. And again, this is just the dream Kings. I'm not saying, hey, their management's a bunch of idiots, right? The whole purpose of this assignment is imagine how crazy they could have been, right?
Okay. Continue.
So now you've got Cousins and you've got Kawhi. The next year, guess what? They screwed it up again. Thomas Robinson. So let's just give them Damian Lillard, right?
Okay.
He was the very next guy drafted. So now your core is Damian Lillard, Kawhi, and Cousins. maybe not quite good enough to get you over the hump. So let's give them one more pick. Okay, how about that? Oh, they take Ben McLemore. That's worked out great. Here are some options. How about the very next pick, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope? He's turning into a max-type player to me in terms of role guy. He'd fit great next to Lillard. Oh, how about Giannis Antetokounmpo, or however you want me to pronounce him with the D? How about that in 2013? Well, would that still be enough? I mean, they do still have some projects, right? Let's fast forward to 2014. They took Stauskas. Well, that wasn't the best move. Now they could have the age-old Sharp-Golliver debate. They could have Zach LaVine. They could have Rodney Hood if they wanted. That looked pretty good. But guess what? They're still not done because they kept screwing up their picks. Maybe they could have one more in 2015. In 2015, they take Willie Cauley-Stein instead of guys like Devin Booker, another Sharp favorite, maybe a Miles Turner in the mix, depending on how you want to do it. So my point is this, their roster right now could be Lillard at the one, Kawhi Leonard and Giannis on the wings with a Rodney Hood in the mix, potentially Cousins and Devin Booker, if they had just nailed best case scenario, like six straight drafts. Now, obviously, some of those would probably have pulled them out of the far reaches. But remember, guys like Giannis slipped, Kawhi slipped. So it wouldn't have had to be the situation where they were, like a playoff team or whatever. It was still could have possibly happened. So I think that team, I mean, that's multiple Hall of Famers. You know, we're talking about Giannis, Cousins, Kawhi, Hall of Famers. Lillard, you know, perennial all-star, fringe type guy, but certainly a much better point guard than anybody's gone through there in years. Plus, you throw another guy with Devin Booker, you know, monster upside role guys, and Rodney Hood. That team is unbelievable.
It's a solid squad. All right, first of all, do you like how I cleared out for 2 minutes to let you run through 6 years of NBA history there?
Yeah, well, look, it was a thorough answer, okay? I prepared for once in my life.
You were very prepared. Let me add a couple things. First of all, that segment should have come with a trigger warning for Kings fans, and I apologize to everyone. I did not know that Ben was going that direction. I also should add that I think in the Kawhi draft, the Kings took Jimmer over Klay Thompson, and given that they play the same position and Klay was very much in the mix where the Kings were picking, that's pretty indefensible. We should probably check that, but I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. And the other thing, I think that the Kawhi example is instructive because if Kawhi had gone to the Kings, there's no way he turns into the player he is today. And that's true for almost every player you mentioned. So I think the bigger what if here is what if the Sacramento Kings had ruined all of these superstars? Klay Thompson, Kawhi Leonard,
the alternate universe.
Yeah, they could have ended Devin Booker's life. Who knows how many different superstars they could have ended.
Well, I mean, remember, the Thunder sprang up from a dog food factory, as Lee likes to put in all of his stories about Oklahoma City, right? So at some point, if you get two or three amazing talents and those guys are pushing each other on a regular basis, does that give you this new culture? Does that help attract better coaching talent? Does that start this thing going in the right direction? Are we totally sure the Kings would have ruined Giannis and Kawhi and Lillard and Cousins? I don't know. And is Cousins the same guy today if he's surrounded by those kinds of talent right when he first gets into the league? You know, if his waiting period to have a real help is only a year or two instead of 6 or 7 years, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm mostly joking, but I'm also pretty serious about a couple of those guys. I don't think Giannis would have developed the way he has without some of the people in Milwaukee who have helped him and helped sort of channel his game in certain directions.
All I'm saying is these guys are going to push the Dream Thunder, right? The Dream Kings in a perfect scenario are going to give the Dream Thunder a pretty good series.
Yeah. So next question from Jonathan Kaysen. Will the available cap room to signable players ratio going down lead to significant year-by-year deflation of deal size? That's an awfully technical question. Do you have a take? I guess let's just ask, what do you think contracts are going to look like in the new CBA?
Well, we're not there yet. I mean, I get kind of what he's saying. Like, are there going to be less of the second or third tier guys who are getting outrageously overpaid because the smart Chris Pauls and LeBrons of the world are hoarding more of the money for themselves?
I kind of think that's what he's saying. And that's like, I definitely think that's the end game for all this, is that there's going to be an upper class, and then there's going to be a much smaller middle class. And then a lot of guys are going to be making like minimum or slightly above.
Yeah, I think you're still going to have the rookie deals going up. You're still having the exceptions going up. So there's going to be this period still of sticker shock where guys are going to be getting contracts, and there's going to be this, oh, I can't believe he got that.
Yeah.
But I think, didn't you write a piece saying that, you know, the Kings being able to have this monster extension with Cousins is like a bad sign of what's to come in terms of free agency movement for stars, because it pretty much locks those guys into their current spots.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest takeaway here of what people should be looking at is, you know, we were jokingly calling them stranded stars and trying to figure out ways to move these guys and have them team up. And the money could get so ridiculous that it could be just more fun to be a one-man band, whatever, and cash out and go home in mid-April and don't worry about it if the difference is going to be, you know, over a 4 or 5 year contract, like $100 million. I mean, that's the kind of money nobody should turn down.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I think it may lead to more trade demands because guys are still going to want to leave, and like, it's not productive for either side to keep Boogie there. So I'm curious as to how it breaks down for Paul George the same way. But to answer Jonathan's question, like the first guy I thought of was Kent Bazemore. Like, I don't think once teams figure out how to really operate under the cap, I don't think someone like Kent Bazemore is going to be making $70 million.
Yeah, it's tricky because on paper, he's your 3-and-D wing and everybody wants those guys. So it's possible, but maybe he has to have more than one really strong season in a contract year before he gets paid.
Yeah.
But there's been a lot of those kinds of guys tricking GMs, you know, like if you look like you're that breakout 3-and-D guy, you're worth your weight in gold. And teams really are hesitant to let those guys go now. You know, maybe the variance in that kind of player, whether he has a poor shooting season, whether a key lead ball handler gets traded and that affects his ability to get clean shots. I mean, whatever it might be. I mean, those guys might not be as rock solid commodities as some GMs thought. And so maybe there is a little bit of, more care given when you're pricing those guys out. But
that mold
of player, I think, is still going to continue to be paid in a big time way. The Danny Green of the world is going to continue to get paid. I mean, he gave San Antonio a bunch of money back, but if he was trying to maximize his money on the open market, I think he would have had a crazy contract.
I'm just kind of looking at it as teams are going to have to commit a lot of money to two or three players, and then some of the guys who would otherwise be valuable, teams are going to have to say, like, is he valuable enough to tie up like long-term cap space that we could use on a star instead.
Yeah, and I think, to me, when you're prioritizing the skills in terms of where you get the money to, those two-way wings are going to still get paid. Maybe the backup centers, the defensive specialist centers, maybe the isolation score, post-score type guys, I could see them taking a big hit because the game's just kind of going away from them.
Yeah.
Just paying purely based on height, you know, or rim protection. I could see that being something where teams are like, nah, we're going to pass on the Biombos and the Mahinmis of the world because you know, they're not living up to those contracts.
You need that money for A, role players, and B, like the Wizards have to pay $100 million to Otto Porter this summer. So like that would hurt a lot less if you didn't spend like $65 million on Mahinmi, who's not really a starter.
You know, that's a great example because I'm very confident in any, you know, year going forward, next 2-3 years, a guy like Otto Porter is absolutely going to get paid. But a guy like a Monta Ellis type, inefficient bucket getter, I could see his value or players in that same mold really coming down, especially if you already have your key primary playmaker, you know, in the Pacers case, maybe a Jeff Teague.
Yeah.
I think Jeff Teague still gets paid because he's that number one playmaking guy with the ball in his hands. that secondary guy who's less efficient, maybe he's a little bit older. I think markets for those guys are just going to disappear.
Yeah, I agree. Next question from Third Brock. As a DMV native who moved to Texas for college, what are the reasons to continue trying to follow the Wiz? The reason is John Wall. We've gone 45 minutes into this podcast. I just finished watching Wall versus the Knicks, and it's been hard to talk about anything else, but he was awesome. I think he had 29 and 14 tonight and won it in the final minute. And Wall alone makes the Wizards worth it.
Yeah, I got into an epic debate this week between myself supporting Wall as a starter and the hordes of drunk on green beer Celtics fans and media analysts supporting Isaiah Thomas.
Was this post pod? Were they responding to your takes earlier in the week?
It was with my All-Star column because I had had Wall as a starter with Lowry in the backcourt instead of Isaiah. And look, I thought the end of that Knicks game was a great example of what Wall can do for you. He does it on both ends. You know, the unbelievable defensive rebound run out completely shakes Brandon Jennings in the open court and finishes it with a dunk. How many point guards in the league can do that? Obviously, Russell Westbrook, not too many others.
The end of the game was pretty funny because prior to him completely taking over the final 90 seconds, he spent like two or three possessions going one-on-one with Porzingis at the top of the key and settling for 19-foot jumpers that missed pretty badly. And like, that's an example of the John Wall that drives me insane. And it's funny how like with your favorite player, you know their weaknesses as well as you know their strengths. And like year after year, Wall has taken those shots. And so I was like, kind of losing my mind. And then at the end, he just takes over. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is why I will give my life for John Wall. He's the best.
Yeah, for sure. He had properly calculated how hard he needed to play to beat the Knicks. And it turns out it was only the last like 60 to 75 seconds. No, it was the full John Wall experience. I think he had some free throw issues, too. But not only was there that amazing athleticism in the open court, but then the defensive discipline on the final play to contest, you know, strip and make a game-saving play defensively as well. And it goes back to that conversation we had about, you know, Wall might not be defensive player of the year, but when you're comparing him to Isaiah Thomas, they're not even in the same galaxy in terms of impact. And that was it right there. I mean, I thought that final stretch, that was his all-star starter case boiled down into a nutshell, even if it wasn't perfect, like you mentioned.
So I think you're being too hard on Isaiah, but I don't want to have that argument again. I think you're leaning too much on the real plus minus stat. I don't think he's that awful. And I do think that the Celtics have other defensive issues. At some point, people are going to start talking about how kind of average Horford has been this year, which hurts. Like, I actually really like Horford now and was pumped for them to get him, but he's been kind of rough.
Yeah, I'm going to need to give you some more stats here. Hold on one second.
No,
we're looking at defensive ratings, individual player defensive ratings for the Celtics. Now, Isaiah Thomas, when he is off the court, Boston's defensive rating is 99, which is excellent, right? No other player on Boston has an off-court defensive rating basically better than 102, right? When he is on the court, Isaiah Thomas's defensive rating is 110.2, which is just god awful. So basically, everything that Joel Embiid does to make Philadelphia's defense better, that's Isaiah Thomas's impact the other way, making Boston's defense worse. Again, you go right down the list. I mean, his on-court defensive rating is just so much worse than a lot of their other key players. I mean, he is clearly the weak link. It's not just a fluke in the defensive real plus minus formula, as some Celtics people were trying to tell me. No, he's bad. No. We've got to accept it.
I'm not arguing that he's good on defense. I'm just arguing that like there are other pieces of that roster that are underperforming. Like I had an NBA guy earlier in the year say that Avery Bradley has fallen off on the defensive end more than people realize, as his scoring has, I mean, he's scoring well, but like he's known as a stopper and has not been playing that well this year on that end. And like, I just think that like focusing on the defense with Isaiah misses the broader story with that team, which is that they've built a team full of guys who are not, most of whom are best served as sixth men. The other superstar, Horford, is underperforming. And the reason that that team is working as well as it is strictly because Isaiah has been like out of control all year.
Well, they have a lot of issues. I mean, Brad Stevens is going to always point to second chance points. You know, I mean, their defensive rebounding and just getting
rebounding
hammered there.
Is atrocious. I mean, like, there are all kinds of stuff. And Isaiah deserves
I had somebody try to tell me that Isaiah is an MVP candidate. I think he was mimicking Kevin Garnett's Area 21 argument on behalf of Isaiah. That is ludicrous. I mean, I felt like I was in a completely different galaxy listening to this idea that Isaiah Thomas is an MVP candidate.
Can I just say, as someone who has like made crazy homer claims about John Wall's MVP candidacy from time to time over the past few years, when a fan says that, I mean, sometimes they're crazy enough to say that they actually deserve MVP, but like when I've said that, what I mean is that like John Wall might deserve like a handful of fifth place votes in the MVP voting. I don't mean that he's like an actual MVP, but I'm saying like he should be in the conversation. So maybe that's what the drunk Celtics fans meant.
Okay, Celtics fans should go buy his jersey. That doesn't mean he needs to be in the MVP conversation. Next question.
Fair enough. Next question. All right, we've got a batch of three regarding the playoffs. Dan Schaefer asks, which team would be the most interesting 4 through 8 seeds in the East? Which teams are most likely to be in those spots? Warren Desmond asks, who would you most like to see make the 8th seed in the West versus who will actually make it? And Hunter at Not Gatherer asks the same thing about the 8th seed. So who, start with the West, because it's a straight up mess. And I like, who would I want to see? I definitely want to see the Wolves because I think it would be fun to see them against the Warriors. Whereas like every other option there, there's Portland, there's Sacramento, there's Denver, New Orleans, like the Lakers would be kind of fun, I guess. But like D'Angelo Russell's having his own issues right now. All of those teams suck. So let's get the Wolves in there because the Wolves at least are going to be good.
Don't see it. The team that I want as the 8th seed is the Pelicans. I'm officially on the bandwagon.
Okay, that's
fair. The impact with Drew Holiday has been awesome. They've been much better with him. They've been much more professional. And like, here's my ultimate reasoning behind it. Two points. One, they already had a pretty fairly entertaining first round series a few years ago with the Warriors. So you know you're going to have a crazy Anthony Davis 40-point game. That's just going to happen. And there's going to be lots of points scored. It's going to be a good time. Probably ultimately not going to be that competitive of a series, but at least it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Compare
definitely.
That to like a Nuggets series, or God forbid you let the Blazers defense on the court in the playoffs. Yeah. Like,
and then Golden State just scores 150 points a game. And that's like not that fun for anybody.
Yeah. Everybody shuts it down halfway through the third quarter. And you know, everybody's talking about, oh, can Terry Stotts survive this? You know, we don't really want that conversation. We more want like this uplifting Pelican story. But
yeah,
the more important point than that, they need to get back in the playoffs so that somebody might actually sign with them this summer, because they have another big summer where they really have to find some help for Davis. And if we can get into the, hey, they're on the national stage, everybody's watching their playoff games, look how good Anthony is, wow, he averaged 40-20 for a series, even Draymond's struggling to stop him, like whatever conversation comes from that can only help their ability to, number one, kind of keep Holiday, but then number two, build around that core. So I'm on Team Pelicans. I'm flying high. Also unrelated to anything, but the Pelican is my favorite bird.
Nice. All right. What about the East? Do you have any idea of, because the East is another thing where like every team is clustered within a game or two of each other.
I have a very specific formula how I want it to go down.
Okay.
Okay. Cleveland number one, Toronto number two, Boston number three, Milwaukee number four, Indiana number five, Washington number six, Atlanta number seven, and then Chicago number eight. Here's why. I want Chicago, Cleveland in the first round, Jimmy versus LeBron.
Okay.
I want Toronto, Atlanta in the first round series. Nobody's going to watch. Throw it on NBA TV. That's fine. Toronto can come out and get excited about it.
Yeah, that's a great NBA TV series.
Then I want Boston versus Washington, so we can have the Isaiah Thomas versus John Wall bloodbath duel to the death. And then obviously 4 or 5 Bucks versus Pacers, so that we can get Giannis versus Paul George as the, like, you know, the centerpiece matchup leading into the second round series against Cleveland. I mean, that's awesome. I don't think there's any weaknesses there.
Yeah, no, that's close to exactly what I picked. I would say I would rather have the Hornets make the playoffs so that we get a little playoff Kemba as the 7th seed. And we can have Raptors Charlotte, which is also a great NBA TV series.
Well, actually, really? Let me amend this. I'm with you. I'm with you. Let's get Millsap off the Hawks so they fall all the way out. If we can trade him to Toronto, let's put Charlotte in at 7. I like that.
Okay. I'm with you too. First of all I care about is that there's a Wizards-Celtics playoff series, because those teams seem to hate each other. They were like, the last game they played in Boston was really chippy. I'm pretty fired up for next week's rematch in DC. But the thing I'm worried about is the Bucks. I don't know if the Bucks are actually going to finish in the middle of the East at this point.
Look, it's really easy to ride their roller coaster. I mean, a couple weeks ago, I was completely confident that they're 4th best team. Now they're not even in the playoff picture, I think, as of today. But big picture, I think they're going to be able to do it. I think the Middleton thing is going to be, you know, a necessary booster. I think they should be buyers at the trade deadline if possible. I don't know if that is going to be a big move, but
yeah,
I mean, now's the time to do it. I mean, you've got the momentum. How often does it come along? You've got this superstar guy. Show them that you're committed. Their owners are rich as hell. They might as well go for it.
Yeah, I think that they will make the playoffs somehow. I'm more curious as to whether they make that 4-5 matchup or are closer to like an 8 seed. Either way, in addition to Wiz Celtics, we need Bucks Cavs for 7 games, or 5, or whatever, however long Milwaukee lasts. I want to see Giannis and LeBron in the playoffs.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I wanted LeBron to have to go through the Bulls and Jimmy, and you get the Wade factor too of like, yeah, oh, the buddy hugs, and oh, now it's serious time. Now we're going to be angry. You know, you get all that nonsense. You get that in the first round. Then you get LeBron versus either Giannis or Paul George in the second round. And then whoever comes out of the other side of the bracket, I mean, Toronto, Boston, Washington, I mean, that's going to be an absolute bloodbath. I mean, one of those, you know, there's going to be flagrant fouls galore when those teams eventually go through each other. And whoever's left standing, they deserve to get taken down by the Cavs. I mean, that's fine. So I think that's the perfect playoff bracket in the Eastern Conference.
All right. Let's run through, let's do 5 more questions.
We're going for another hour and a half, okay?
No, let's keep the answers short. I'm going to run through. Matthew asked, Jabari basically said kid wouldn't let him shoot threes for a while to work inside. Should Phoenix do that with Marquise Chris and Dragon Bender? I have no idea what Phoenix should do. They should probably trade some people so that the roster is a little bit less insane. But beyond that, I don't really have Suns takes at this point in the year. I'm not even gonna let you answer that one.
No, I have a quick answer. I have a quick answer for this though, because back in the Portland days, there actually was a rule for Travis Outlaw where if he dribbled the ball more than twice consecutively, it was an immediate benching. Mm-hmm. So they were just trying to like adjust him to life in the NBA. And so this idea of like Jason Kidd going to Jabari and saying, look, you know, you got to do more than just chuck away. That's like a real thing that coaches do.
Yeah.
And I think Marquise Chris has some Travis Outlaw tendencies, you know, in terms of just kind of space cadet moments. And so it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But, you know, if you're Phoenix, getting that guy minutes, you know, like legitimate minutes, even if he is one of the worst guys playing in the league right now, that counts for something long term. And it's probably better than running out mediocre veterans in pursuit of some short term goal that is worthless. So I'm okay with it.
Okay. I agree. They should give those guys minutes. I'm more like, I think they should probably deal some of the other guys so that the roster makes a little bit more sense. But anyways, next question. I structured this carefully so that we'd stick with the theme. Anyone else notice that Jabari is shooting 41% from 3 on 3.5 attempts per game? I did notice that. He's been fucking awesome this year. I'm a fantasy owner, and he continues to surprise me night to night.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was going to have to come if he was going to be, you know, become the guy worthy of that draft spot. So that's great progress to see this early, and keep it going.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably just turned off the podcast, but we're good. All right, couple more. Trey asks, F, marry, kill, Scalabrine, Bonner, Sean Bradley.
Well, you got to marry Bonner. Did you see they retired his plaid in San Antonio, and one of the most San Antonio things of all time? They hung up one of his plaid shirts in the locker room and had a little ceremony for it.
Yeah.
And that was right after his viral video where he's announcing his retirement to nobody. So clearly Bonner's the marry. Just,
I think the only reason I included this question is because you have to marry Matt Bonner. I think like one night stand with Scalabrine would be okay. I think anything after that, and he would turn into the person that you kill. Sean Bradley, I don't have strong feelings either way. So I don't want to murder Sean Bradley, but I wouldn't choose him.
Yeah, I'm good on the other parts of that question.
I figured. Next question from Jake Circa. Power rank the great new NBA names. Lonzo Ball, Dragon Bender, Malik Monk, Thon Maker, Justin Winslow, all elite. Do you have any opinions?
They're all tied for first. I mean, they're all amazing. I'm not really a Game of Thrones guy, so I never got that hard into the Bender love. But Lonzo Ball and then his younger brothers also have amazing names. I think that's probably the direction that I'd go. Justice Winslow is another one, especially because it's spelled wrong. I got to give that love.
Malik Monk sounds like a character from an early 90s basketball movie. So he is my number one easily. Justice Winslow is number two. Dragon Bender versus Ball versus Thon Maker. Yeah, all those guys are tied. The only other guy I'm getting into the draft, and Lauri Markkanen from Arizona. That's just a great name for like a European sniper. He's a 7 foot stretch four. And Edmund Sumner from Xavier, who's like a pretty underrated point guard prospect. Sounds like British royalty.
Yeah, that's a great point. I do think Malik Monk probably averaged 20 for Tupac's summer league team and above the rim, didn't he?
Basically, I was imagining a Tupac basketball movie, like above the rim adjacent, and Malik Monk would be the star.
I love it.
Last question here from George Frazier. Are dog days hot takes worthless? Like Dubs fourth quarter suckage, Cavs passing woes, Beard or Russ turning human? Mexico wants to know.
Thanks, George. Well, I did devote like 4 days of my life to writing a story about the Warriors fourth quarter suckage.
This is a
direct, really hope it wasn't
this is
worthless.
A direct shot at you.
Yeah, I did feel that one right in my heart. No, I don't think they're worthless, but yeah, clearly we're overanalyzing because we've got two teams that can win the title, maybe three if you're feeling really generous and have a favorite squad you want to throw in there. But, you know, we nitpick these guys because at some point it comes out, right? We learned that lesson in the playoffs last year. And I don't think either one of these teams are immune from it, whether it's Cleveland or Golden State. They haven't been perfect. Obviously, Golden State's response to their fourth quarter issues against Memphis has been unbelievable. I mean, blowout victories over basically everybody they play. So clearly they're in on it. And that is one thing I like about these kind of developing or marinating midseason narratives is that everybody follows them, kind of including the players and the coaches and everybody else too. So it's like if you're Kevin Durant or you're the Warriors and you don't like to hear this talk about, oh, we're struggling in the fourth quarter, you can just go out and smack teams by 20 points 5 nights in a row. And that story goes away. So the feedback loop there between the media and the players is pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point because I was going to say that like 90% of NBA regular season analysis is kind of worthless because like there are like 4 months of dog days for the NBA regular season. Most of the narratives are kind of already set after the first 6 weeks. But it's a good point that like the players all pay attention and sort of adjust accordingly or get pissed off accordingly. So that's true, you know? Maybe they all read your Warriors skepticism and that's why they're playing so well this week.
I'm not going to take credit for it, but I do think like they're getting asked those questions every day, right? So whether they read it or not, they're being forced to confront it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I was Kevin Durant, the last thing I want to hear is that I'm a choker in the clutch who's screwing up Golden State's offense. You know, whether or not to this point, the stats suggest that's sort of what was happening. And he has the ability every single night to go out there and write a new narrative. And the new narrative is Golden State's untouchable because they just blew the Cavaliers out and nobody else can hang within 20 points of them. That's fine. And that one may collapse again as somebody else pops up. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's it. We have one update from a previous, from last week's mailbag. Brian, who asked the question about the, about Draymond and KD and Draymond flipping out at KD.
The shot caller guy, right? This guy who said that we should put a shot caller on KD every time he tries to shoot in the clutch because that way you can break his bad habit.
It was actually you who said that, but yes. The highly
memorable
negative
event. No, I didn't say that. I was interpreting what he said.
Right. So Brian says, hey, positive punishment is a real thing, and links to a Wikipedia entry on positive punishment. And he says, I'm so mortified that you read that on air. And I also had a friend in the medical community reach out to me because I said I thought that that had been debunked. And he said, classical conditioning has not been debunked as a mechanism, but it has been rejected as a learning tool for ethical reasons. For more, check out the Little Albert experiment on Wikipedia. So I encourage everyone to go check out the Little Albert experiment and think of Draymond and Kevin Durant.
Let me guess, like Little Albert's like a chronic masturbator who just can't control himself in class or something?
No, it's actually pretty disturbing. Using negative stimuli, they taught a like 9-month-old baby to be afraid of furry animals. And then when that child grew up, apparently he was still afraid of furry animals. So that would have... Long story short, that child could be Kevin Durant in crunch time come playoff time.
So Draymond is being pretty unethical. Well, look, I have an alternate solution, though.
What?
I went back and looked at all of the baskets that Kevin Durant made in the clutch this year.
Yep.
And there was a very clear theme. They were all set up by his teammates with beautiful assists, and they were all really easy looks that he either finished as dunks, wide open three-pointers, wide open mid-range shots. So
yeah.
We don't need to do the shot caller, okay? We need to... Really
I was
going to
guess the theme is the pick and roll with Steph.
No, not even necessarily that. Just great ball movement. And I think, you know, let's take the Hillary Clinton approach, okay? It takes a village to raise a child. We don't need to outcast Kevin Durant and try to break him of these bad habits. We just need to surround him with positivity and love and show him the videotape of him having success in this positive learning environment and realizing that passes make everything better. And that's really what's worked for him so far this season. Iguodala has really been one of the key guys to get him going late in games with his passes, whether it's lobs or just finding him for jumpers. So I think that that's a more proven, less unethical learning strategy to employ on Kevin Durant. What do you think?
Totally. Teamwork makes the dream work. And that's a good place to end. You got in your political analogy for the show. We will be back next week, and we didn't get to a bunch of questions, including some more Celtics arguments and some other stuff. So we'll come back and next Tuesday, and then first mock draft next week. I'm excited.
That should be great. All right, everyone. Thanks for the questions. Keep sending them in. Please, 5-star reviews on iTunes. Those are our oxygen. We need them to survive in this world. Andrew, I'll talk to you next week.
All right, man. Take it easy.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.